Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Governor Rick Scott says the legislature's decision not to fund his economic incentive plan could be a big setback for Florida, not to mention the agency that would have gotten the money.
You know what it's like in business. Once you lose your momentum, it's hard work to get it back again. We have momentum.
Also this week, the opt-out protest is alive and well in Florida as school testing season gets underway.
Protesting isn't supposed to be comfortable. This is civil disobedience. It's protest. We're here to fight for something. We're here to fight against something.
We'll also hear about the debate in the state cabinet over who Florida's next insurance commissioner should be and learn that cheaper isn't necessarily better when it comes to your grocery bill. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. Enterprise Florida is facing a major reorganization. Regan McCarthy reports that's after the legislature denied a request from Governor Rick Scott to give the agency $250 million for economic incentives.
At the start of the last legislative session, Florida Governor Rick Scott told the legislature without more money for Enterprise Florida, the state could start losing jobs from companies that would otherwise consider a move to Florida. Scott spoke about the issue during a meeting with Enterprise Florida board members.
Here's where we're going to end up. Basically, where Enterprise Florida is, we're pretty much out of money. So for the next 5.5 months left in this session, 5 months left in this year, fiscal year, we can't do a deal. What that does to you is you deal with these 6,000 or so site selectors in the country. They say, why talk to Florida? Why waste the time? And you know what it's like in business. Once you lose your momentum, it's hard work to get it back again. We have momentum.
And toward the end of the legislative session, it appeared the governor would get the funding he requested. The governor and Senate president spoke with members of the press during the height of the budgeting process. Here's Senate President Andy Gardner.
We're in the Appropriations Committee right now, and as of right now, the Senate position is the $250 million for EFI. As I've said, I think the governor's made a very strong case, and we're kind of building the budget now.
But by the end of the session, the legislature had zeroed out nearly all of the new economic development dollars heading to Enterprise Florida. Lawmakers did fund the agency's operating budget, and now Governor Scott is looking for a new way forward. In a letter the governor sent at the end of March to Enterprise Florida's board, Scott says he's left with no choice but to refocus the efforts and mission of Enterprise Florida. Scott talked with reporters about the plan after a recent cabinet meeting.
You know, we got to go through and say, okay, what should EFI be doing now? So Bill Johnson's going to help with that review. Dave Wilkins going to help with that review. But it's really go back, and I think we ought to be doing it with a lot of things. Just go back and say, okay, how are we spending the dollars? Let's make sure dollars are spent well. We're going to get a return, and that's what we're thinking about doing.
In his letter, Scott says he's asked former Department of Children and Families Secretary David Wilkins to help identify $6 million in savings from the state funding Enterprise Florida did receive. Scott points out the agency spends $9 million in payroll, and some have questioned whether that will mean pink slips for agency workers. Scott echoed his previous answer, saying David Wilkins and Bill Johnson will take a hard look at the agency's spending. Johnson served as Enterprise Florida president and CEO before he abruptly stepped down around the time the governor sent his letter. But Scott maintains Johnson will be part of the transition. Scott praises Johnson for his work, but says it's time for Enterprise Florida to change.
The legislature didn't fund the Quick Action Closing Fund. It's a lot of what Enterprise Florida does to go out and try to attract companies. We have won over 500 competitive projects all across the state, we've got a transition in Enterprise Florida. They're not being funded the same way.
Scott says he'd like to look for ways to transition Enterprise Florida from a largely state-funded entity to one with a greater dependence on private funding. He's asked Wilkins to identify Enterprise Florida functions that could be privatized. Wilkins is expected to present his findings at the agency's board meeting in May. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Well, it's the fifth season of the year in Florida, testing season, and millions of Florida's public school students from third grade through 12th are taking the Florida Standards Assessment, the FCAT, and end-of-course exams. These tests have drawn scorn from parents, teachers, school administrators, even lawmakers, yet they remain the main measure of how schools and districts are graded, kids promoted, and teachers evaluated. Lynn Hatter reports some parents and kids are protesting, choosing a form of civil disobedience by opting out.
About 20 people have come out for one of the Leon County School District's community conversations, but at least a quarter of them are school district officials.
There are a lot of teachers that are putting that kind of pressure on those students or those parents.
In Florida, there's no such thing as opting out of a state exam. All public school students must take them. The Florida Department of Education uses a series of codes to record tests that end up without a score, though, and that could be for a range of reasons. One of those codes, NR2, is used when tests are incomplete, a popular move for opt-outers. The Orlando Sentinel reported there were 20,000 of those exams last year, up from 5,500 in 2014. That's still a small fraction of the 1.7 million kids who are tested each year. According to fairtest.org, New York led the nation with more than 220,000 kids refusing exams, and Louisiana recorded 5,000. Opt-out proponents like Orlando's Cindy Hamilton say despite small numbers overall, the movement is growing.
We're here to protest. Protesting isn't supposed to be comfortable. This is civil disobedience. It's protest. Mm-hmm. We're here to fight for something. We're here to fight against something.
The Opt Out Florida Network links local groups together and had recently published a detailed guide for refusing Florida exams. The length families go to keep their kids from being tested is intense, from staying home throughout the testing period to breaking the seal on the exam but not filling it out. Opt Out Leon's Beth Overholt says those moves are not without risks.
You know, a lot of people opt out by keeping their child at home, and I've heard that. Beth, just keep your kid at home. Well, then you run into the truancy issue, and I don't want it to be the secret handshake. Beth, we know your child's opting out, so they're not going to get in trouble. They're not going to have a truancy issue if you keep them home through all the testing windows. It should be a little more clear. And
anything the state deems as an excessive absence could end up with a family having to fight it out in court. And parent Kelly Hartsfield says she ran into confusion from teachers at her children's schools when she tried to keep her kids from taking Florida's exams.
But I still had to go pick up my kids because they would not provide any kind of alternate environment for them. And last year, it was no issue.
You know, what keeps kids in school every day is their love of their teachers, their love of music, and love of school. And those are things that we've tried to reinforce.
Last year, only 18 Leon County students opted out of the tests. Leon County School Superintendent Jackie Pons has long derided the way Florida uses standardized tests to grade schools and districts, and more recently, teachers. And he's no fan of the Florida Standards Assessment. Pond says he wants to work with opt-out parents to develop a way for principals and teachers to handle families that choose to opt out. But he says he'd prefer they take the test.
And some of the students that don't end up testing are some of my best students. You know, I know that. So that's kind of a selfish thing, I would tell you. But I'd like to have them in there if I could. So I would say that. So I'm being totally honest with you. You know, I'd love to have them do it. But I do understand.
Schools, districts, and teachers are judged and rated based largely on those assessments. Students can be promoted or retained based on their performance. Good scores yield more money, so districts have an incentive to test. But it's that same emphasis that's frustrated parents. Judging the size of the opt-out movement is tricky. Since there's no such thing as opting out, come later this spring when scores come back, education watchers will be counting the number of codes like NR2 and NT. Those could suggest whether a kid opted out of the exam. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the ecological disaster in Florida's Indian River Lagoon may require a long-term fix.
The Indian River Lagoon is being attacked on multiple fronts, and until we address all of the various issues, we're not going to have a healthy system. We need to react, and we need to fix the problems now.
Florida's cabinet is deadlocked in its effort to find a new insurance commissioner this week, but CFO Jeff Atwater knows who he wants for the job.
I'd like to make a motion that the position of the Commissioner of Insurance and Regulation be extended to Representative Bill Hager with a salary of $190,000.
And all of us are looking for ways to cut down on what we pay for food, right? Well, maybe cheap isn't always better.
And then there's the true cost of cheap food. Something we want to address is, you know, you're paying for it now or you're paying for it later.
An outbreak of brown tide being blamed for a massive fish kill in the northern Indian River Lagoon is dissipating, that according to the latest reports, but scientists are worried it may signal a tipping point for a crippled ecosystem that makes up nearly one-third of Florida's east coast, as we hear from Jim Ash.
The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission is the lead response agency when an outbreak like brown tide occurs. Executive Director Nick Wiley took a recent tour of the Banana River from Kennedy Space Center to Patrick Air Force Base in Cocoa Beach.
Naturally, a brown tint, but you can see through it, and it was still pretty cloudy in a lot of places, showing that we still got some brown algal bloom. And I saw actually very few floating fish. It seems that the fish kill has waned pretty significantly.
Experts blame brown algae. Measurable concentrations started rising in late fall, says Zach Judd, Director of Education for the Florida Oceanographic Society.
What we saw last week was a situation where the bloom suddenly crashed, meaning that all the algae died off. And as the algae died, their remaining cells were devoured by bacteria that pulled oxygen out of the estuary and rudders.
A freeze caused a major fish kill in 2010, but this one was much worse, Judd says. It claimed millions of fish, everything from blue crabs and spotted trout to red and black drum. He estimates 50 species were involved. Blooms start when fertilizer from farms and front lawns and pollution from septic tanks wash into the lagoon. The phosphorus and nitrogen make tiny plant populations explode. Judd says not enough is being done to limit runoff.
The Indian River Lagoon is being attacked on multiple fronts, and until we address all of the various issues, we're not going to have a healthy system. We need to react, and we need to fix the problems now.
A superbloom of green algae struck the northern half of the lagoon in 2011 and lasted an unprecedented 8 months. It killed 60% of seagrasses in the affected area, reversing decades of recovery. Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute researcher Dennis Hanisak is worried. The latest disaster may eventually confirm suspicions the superbloom was signaling a tipping point, he says.
I think that it was a clear warning that we're close to a tipping point. It's kind of a subjective call.
Governor Rick Scott reminded reporters this week his administration has directed $60 million in restoration projects in the past 3 years. This year, more than $20 million will be spent on dredging projects to remove polluted muck. Florida Department of Environmental Protection Deputy Secretary Drew Bartlett says regulators are working on plans to keep the nutrients out.
We are in the process of developing projects with local governments, local drainage districts, to further limit pollution getting to the lagoon.
Meanwhile, scientists say they won't be surprised to see more blooms this summer. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Florida's cabinet is at odds over who should become the state's next insurance commissioner. Nick Evans reports the candidate search is back on, and cabinet officials are hoping to agree on a successor at their next meeting.
At Tuesday's cabinet meeting, state officials conducted interviews with two finalists in a bid to replace Florida's current top insurance regulator. Office of Insurance Regulation, or OIR, Commissioner Kevin McCarty will leave that post in early May. The interview process began with Jeffrey Bragg, a former Treasury official who set up and oversaw the Terrorism Risk Insurance Program. Bragg boasts 40 years in the insurance industry, working in the public and private sector, and he's seen as Governor Scott's favorite for the position. He pitched himself as a willing functionary for the cabinet.
As the COO, I don't make policy. I implement your policy, and I'm responsible to you and each and every one of you, in some cases on a daily basis, to make sure that your policies are carried out.
And that's exactly what Governor Scott wants to hear. In the past, the governor has shown he's willing to drop the axe on intractable agency heads. At the end of 2014, he pushed out Gerald Bailey, the state's top cop at the time. Bailey alleged the firing came after he rebuffed the governor's efforts to interfere with department investigations. The other finalist up for consideration was Delray Beach Republican Representative Bill Hager.
I know insurance. I know all lines of insurance, and I know them in depth and in detail. I know insurance regulation. I know Florida. I know Florida's politics. I've been an elected official in the state since the year 2002.
Florida's chief financial officer, Jeff Atwater, is backing Hager's bid. In this year's session, they partnered on a bill requiring life insurers take extra steps to pay claims to beneficiaries. Hager's been working in the industry nearly as long as Bragg, and he served as Iowa's insurance commissioner in the late 1980s. Hager and Bragg are Republicans, and both offered a number of boilerplate responses focused on encouraging private companies to participate in Florida's market. But Hager also offered an idea about long-term health care coverage.
For example, one of the things I would like to see from a creative standpoint is life insurance. There's no reason why we ought not be able to work with the industry to, as people get older, see some kind of a conversion from the cash value in life policies, have the flexibility to convert it into long-term care policies, whether through a rider, etc.
Much of the discussion focused on property insurance, but Attorney General Pam Bondi asked both candidates about health insurance in the wake of the Affordable Care Act. And that's where Bragg had a bit of a hiccup.
You have to continually manage the concept that a huge percentage of the premiums have to go back in the form of benefits to the insured.
Well, what about the navigators?
I'm sorry?
The navigators in the Affordable Health Care Act.
I guess I'm not familiar with what you're asking.
Okay.
Navigators help people choose plans on the federal exchange, and Bondi's been suspicious of the program since at least 2013. But state law requires navigators register with the CFO's office, and the agency posts their names on its website. In the end, CFO Atwater moved to give the job to Hager.
Governor, I'd like to make a motion that the position of the Commissioner of Insurance and Regulation be extended to Representative Bill Hager with a salary of $190,000.
But state law demands the CFO and the governor agree. And Governor Scott wasn't biting.
So I won't second it. So.
I think where we ought to be, what we ought to do is, because I don't think we're going to come to, I'm not going to come to agreement right now.
Instead, the cabinet is reopening the search. They'll be taking applications until April 15th, with an eye on approving a new commissioner at the next meeting, April 26th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A new Florida law allows the state to pay for the reburial of boys' remains found on the grounds of the now-defunct Dozier School for Boys, as well as helping take care of the unclaimed remains. As Sasha Cordner reports, some stakeholders are now looking toward next steps associated with the new law.
After Governor Rick Scott recently signed the measure into law, Robert Straley says he thought he'd never see such a day come.
Not only did they close the school, but when Professor Aaron Kimberly and University of South Florida got in there and found the rest of those bodies, then that was really something. I mean, they dug those kids up and got, I believe, 7 or 8 to their families already. And that's more than I could have ever hoped for. And now this.
Straley is part of the organization called the White House Boys, made up of former wards of the Dozier School who say they survive alleged physical and sexual abuse. For decades, the bodies of boys who died from the alleged abuse were rumored to be on the property. A few years ago, researchers had found 51 remains in 55 unmarked graves. Straley says he's just glad the legislature set aside money for the families who were DNA matched with their loved ones to rebury them, and the governor signed it into law with the Florida cabinet support.
You know, this administration really really did a good job of addressing a situation that happened 5 decades ago and brought it into this time period and dealt with it. And nobody has ever done that before. Governor Claude Kirk did stop the floggings, but that's as far as it went. He never brought in the Department of Justice or charged anybody.
The new law, which immediately took effect, also sets up the Dozier Task Force tasked with creating a memorial for the unclaimed remains and determining its location. Made up of different stakeholders, included is a seat for a former ward of Dozier appointed by Florida Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater. There is an application process, and Straley says he's applied because he has knowledge on this issue.
You know, I spent 8 years on this, and I don't think anybody knows this story better than I do. But if somebody else does it, well then, you know, whatever, as long as it gets done. I suggested a mausoleum-type building. It's a granite, beautiful building. You can etch on it and put boys' names, anything really. You could put a picture on there if you wanted to. And so I sent over a recommendation of one company that I found.
Multiple people had a hand in this effort, including Senate Democratic Leader Athenia Joyner, who wrote the new law.
Rights the wrong of a system that not only tolerated these abuses, but looked the other way year after year. We can't change the sins of the past, but we can establish a reminder so that they are never repeated.
Tampa Democratic Representative Edna Rain sponsored the House version.
And while I'm disappointed that in this process we aren't able to identify all the bodies and everyone that was in those grounds, my hope is that we'll be able to bring some measure of closure and comfort to the families. At the end of the day, these boys were placed in the hands of the state, and they deserve better than unmarked graves.
Former Republican Governor Bob Martinez has been working with the White House boys like Robert Straley. He says he's also working to get them some closure.
I had the opportunity over time to talk to some of the surviving young men then, today's most senior citizens, and they have described from time to time what they faced while there. So that I think this is a step the state is needed to do, put some sunshine in a dark period of our history. And I think that part is very, very important.
And Straley says Martinez may be looking to get them some funds as well. He says it's needed because this has destroyed whole families.
I hope that something is done for these men because we've had over 100 men die since this happened and without any closure, you know, and this just wrecked families' lives. It burned through generations. It didn't just affect the men. You know, I've had people call me up. One lady called to thank me, and she says, I now know why my husband beat us so severely, myself and my daughters. And I said, oh, your husband was at Marianne. He said, no, his father was. And there was men out there that, as boys, that were at Marianne, and they reenacted that horrible beatings on their children.
Meanwhile, there have been past legislative efforts to compensate the alleged abuse survivors filed by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, but they never had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, we wind up this Capitol Report with a tasty tidbit about almost everyone's favorite topic, food. According to the USDA, Americans spend about 7% of their income on food. That's one of the lowest percentages in the world. But as Kate Payne reports, there are hidden costs lurking behind that cheap food.
The American supermarket is a modern marvel. Bread played a starring role in the French Revolution and in civil uprisings throughout history, but there's no shortage here. The spice aisle alone is a small miracle. Empires waged wars over nutmeg and cinnamon. Now they're available for $3. And then there's the produce, asparagus, lime, cilantro, tomatoes, crisscrossing the country and the globe. But the price of food doesn't factor in the cost for the environment, health, and flavor.
Like a watershed, we have a food shed where all of our foods come from. Who's growing it? What do they grow? How do they do it?
That's Reuben Fields, owner of a local farm-to-table restaurant called the Miccosukee Root Cellar. Sharon Denard is a food-conscious restaurant owner as well. She runs Nefertari's and says food is an investment in future health.
Food should be your medicine and medicine should be your food. You know, that quote from way back in the day. And it's truer today than ever before because our food...
But for millions of low-income Americans, healthy food is out of reach. Affordable food is fast food loaded with salt, sugar, and empty calories. That's where Sundiata Amael and the I Grow Urban Farm come in.
We're there to bring them in with free food. Hey, come get your free sweet potatoes and free collard greens. You know, it's a way to engage them, open them up to... what it is that we're trying to, impart on them. And it changes lives. It really does. We've seen behavioral changes.
But in the push to meet the demands of a hungry and impatient nation, Sally Sanders with the Ethical Choices Program says we have lost track of industrial agriculture.
The largest cause of environmental destruction, according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, is animal agriculture. Everything else we do is nice. Recycling. Energy efficient light bulbs, all of that is wonderful stuff, water conservation, but that's really a drop in the bucket compared to this issue.
Our current system is designed to provide cheap produce year-round, but for University of Florida horticulture scientist Harry Klee, the real cost of cheap food is flavor.
And there will always be people who will whine and say we shouldn't be eating tomatoes except at the peak of the season. Well, the reality is most people want to eat a tomato all year round, and they don't want to pay very much money for it.
Klee has developed what a panel of 500 consumers are calling the best tomato they've ever tasted.
Everybody who tries the tomato loves it.
And going beyond flavor, Klee's Garden Gem is firm, shippable, and disease-resistant. But it's a little smaller than other conventional varieties, so growers won't sell it.
I'm not paid for something that tastes good. I'm paying for how many pounds of red round objects I put in a box. And so the system is set up in such a way that the big growers, there's no incentive for them to produce something that really tastes good.
Many are quick to blame America's industrial agriculture, but Klee says consumers are complicit as well.
It's real common to blame agriculture for all of this, but I think the consumer also deserves a significant amount of blame here. If you don't buy that tasteless product, then the supermarket isn't going to carry it anymore.
But the system can change. Supermarkets will supply what customers demand. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.